Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, did Sony Pictures do the right thing by canceling the Christmas release date of The Interview because of an apparent terrorist threat? And when, if ever, should the movie open in theaters now? If Sony loses, literally, does North Korea win? And how about that funny plot line with the fictional assassination of an actual world leader? Also today, the Russian currency turns to rubble, the implications for democracy and the price of oil. Matt Parker today, a statistical anomaly as both a mathematician and a comedian. How to survive the holidays when a loved one is in prison. We'll hear one wife story from our Death, Sex, and Money podcast and invite yours on the phone about relationships with kids and inmates. We'll do a follow-up Friday segment and answer the questions we left hanging yesterday about religion. What time of year was Jesus really born? And what is the true percentage of Christians, Muslims, and Jews in the United States? We will answer those questions. And your free holiday classifieds of the air. If you own a local business that sells holiday gifts, we will help you compete today with the big box stores and that online behemoth. Get ready to call in and promote your stuff later in the show. That's all coming up. But first, we say goodbye to one powerful satirist, at least in his current role. After over 9 years in character on his show, Stephen Colbert signed off last night, urging us still to feel from our gut, just like he did 9 years ago on show number one.
Truthiness. I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart. And that's exactly what's pulling our country apart today. Because face it, folks, we are a divided nation. Not between Democrats and Republicans, or conservatives and liberals, or tops and bottoms. No. We are divided between those who think with their head and those who know with their heart.
And if you happen to catch last night's show, the epic send-off with the star-studded musical number and the really heartfelt goodbye from Colbert, you probably did feel it in your gut and in your heart and probably in your head, too. Here's a sample.
In the annals of history, or whatever orifice they stuff it in. Let no one say what we did together was not important or influential or importulential. You see, from the beginning of my show, it was my goal to live up to the name of this network, Influence Central. And if all we achieved over the last 9 years was to come into your home each night and help you make a difficult day a little bit better, man, what a waste. And nation, I want you to know, if I had to do it all again, if I could do it with you, I would do it the same. And that's the word.
So joining me now to talk about the power of Colbert satire and to take your calls as we say goodbye to his character, at least, is Kurt Anderson of Studio 360. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. And in a few minutes, I'll just tell our listeners, we'll also talk about another piece of satire that actually isn't really getting a beginning, let alone an ending. The movie The Interview with Seth Rogen and James Franco is two bumbling journalists setting out to kill the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. What a funny premise for a plot. Kurt, there is so much more to discuss with Colbert than last night's final show, but still, let's start there. What'd you think as a finale?
I thought the fact that they decided not to make it in any sense a normal show and just make it a 22-minute farewell fantasia was delightful and terrific. And this collection of maybe, 100 random famous and maybe famous people sort of all singing a song together. It was, as the show has been, singular and strange.
It was that musical number included, I guess they were all guests on the show at one time or another, and, you know, it was funny to see. It was sort of the political media Sgt. Pepper's album cover, you know.
Exactly right.
With everyone from Terry Gross to Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger is the one that when you saw him, you went, this is kind of amazing.
And our phone lines are open, folks, for your goodbyes to Colbert, 212-433-WNYC. And I want to also ask listeners the serious question. We just heard Colbert's character joke about the network being called Influence Central instead of Comedy Central. Did he influence you? Did you start watching as a college student, maybe? Did he and Jon Stewart actually help form your politics? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you think he influenced you or anyone you know or political discourse in the country in addition to making people laugh? 212-433-9692. And we'll get to some of the very political Colbert highlights as we go. But his influence on you, his influence on anybody you know, his influence on the country, if you think he had an influence on the country, politically speaking, 212-433-9692. And, Kurt, what do you think about that question? I mean, it's not typically the first question we would ask about a comedian,
yeah,
but it's actually a relevant question in this case.
Well, I think that The Daily Show and Colbert together, I wish they'd had more influence in this one extraordinary thing they did, which is this incredibly careful and thorough research they did of collecting video clips and then showing them to show hypocrisy and to show duplicity and everything on the part of newsmakers and politicians. I mean, they say, oh, this is fake news, and of course it is. It's comedy. But they did. They pioneered both those shows. A real this truly journalistic effort that I wish we would see more of that on the television news. So more than influence, I think Stephen Colbert is just an extraordinary performer. He is singular. So I don't know. Influences, I'm sure he had influence, but the fact that he did what he did for 9 years, play this fictional character every night, a thing of which I was highly skeptical when they announced it was going to begin, I'm not sure we will see the likes of such again.
And really, as a bulwark against the hype and the inaccuracy and the sound bites that people would see on TV, like you were just explaining that how effectively they use sound bites and then debunk them. You know, at the height of the Iraq War, there really was no MSNBC in the sense that we think of it now. It came during that period, and now that network is established with Rachel Maddow, et cetera, as kind of the opposite of Fox News. But for quite a while, if you were looking for a liberal pushback on television at all, it was Stewart and Colbert.
That's true, and why I find Stewart and Colbert more gratifying and personally did is that yes, of course they are more liberal than not, but neither of them are in any sense doing, you know, MSNBC style liberal talking points. There is a sense that they are telling the truth as they see it, and it's a truth I tend to agree with more than I don't. And yes, as you say, it's a left critique, but it is not a partisan one or we want to get this person elected. Also, Stephen Colbert had a kind of vision of America, a critique that was consistent. This truthiness thing that you mentioned, and let's not think, let's feel from our gut and know with our heart rather than engage in rational analysis. That was an important and consistent idea that he put across.
You suggest that we play a clip from Colbert's 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was hilarious and polarizing, by the way, down there in D.C., and worth watching again for any of you who didn't catch it when it happened. It's out there online. So let's do this, but remind us briefly of how this came to be. Why would the Bush White House invite Colbert, of all comedians, to skewer the president at this annual dinner with the White House correspondents?
Well, the Bush White House did not invite him. The White House Correspondents Association makes those invitations of the comedian and, you know, Toastmaster or whatever. And they invited him. early on in the existence of the Colbert Report. It was only 6 months after he'd gone on the air, and it was, as one came to expect from Stephen Colbert, pretty brilliant. In his right-wing character mode, the premise was that he was defending President Bush, and again, at the absolute height of the Iraq War. And, of course,
in character as a blowhard conservative talk show host, right?
Correct. And therefore, his mock defense was, in fact, a scathing critique. And at the White House Correspondents' Dinners, the presidents are always right there, and they take shots from the comedians. But this was all about George Bush.
And here is 20 seconds of that. Let's listen.
Most of all, I believe in this president. Now, I know there's some polls out there saying that this man has a 32% approval rating. But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias.
Reality has a well-known liberal bias, Kurt.
Exactly right. And again, I think that is an important thing to say. And as I said before, it was a kind of consistent line that he expressed and explored in various ways. It was interesting that White House Correspondents' Dinner, why I found it so interesting is I was already a Colbert fan. I loved it. I watched it all the time. But you could, in that room, it didn't, except in that clip we heard some laughter, it didn't play well. And I thought that made me love him even more and made me happy I live in New York rather than Washington even more.
As we say goodbye to the Colbert Report after last night's finale, Jason in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to comment. I've been a professor for many years in the New York area, and just talking with my students during this very turbulent time, post-2003 up, my students really came to understand politics and cultural studies a lot more through the satire of Stephen Colbert. And I hear from a lot of times from colleagues, they say, well, do the students understand what he's saying? Do they think he's a conservative pundit as opposed to what he's doing as a performance artist? And I could tell you that my students always got it, and they were always, to a certain extent, ahead of the curve. He really kind of implemented a new kind of ideology and intellectualism in the classroom through his satire.
And do you think that he did shape some of your students' political worldview?
Yeah, I think that he did, especially since I teach mostly minority students. So to a large extent, there's always this idea that, well, you know, is Stephen Colbert speaking to a certain kind of intelligentsia that isn't present in the public university? And I can tell you that my students really did understand and take to it. And it created in them, to a large extent, a certain political ideology that was based on the fact that, hey, we can make fun of the sitting president or Congress in such a way that we won't get in trouble, because a lot of times, mm-hmm. College students are like, well, I don't want to say too much in a class, but Stephen Colbert kind of gave them the ability to do so.
Interesting that he wound up liberating them in that way. Jason, thank you very much. Spencer in Berkeley Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Spencer.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
So I take a slightly different stance towards Colbert and The Daily Show. I think that both of those programs did a great deal to help refine my political views and how I perceived what was going on politically at the various levels of government. What I found both programs to do very well, very much like your program and All Things Considered, is to take a particular topic and delve deeper into it, using humor as the medium in which to get the point across.
Uh-huh. So did he didn't change your mind so much as give you a deeper insight into why you tended to feel the way you did, and maybe even give you some, I'm putting words in your mouth now, but even give you some talking points when you would be in political conversations with others?
Absolutely. It would basically say, if I could say on the surface, listening to All Things Considered, I get two or three layers or levels into a topic through Stewart and Colbert and their associated writers who would go to the fourth or the fifth level, especially when dealing with the humorous, you know, let's flip it and try this role and then present an equally humorous and implausible scenario.
Spencer, thank you very much. So here may be an example of that. In 2012, Colbert set up his own super PAC, Colbert Super PAC Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow. And according to a study done by Annenberg Public Policy Center of the University of Pennsylvania, the Colbert Report did a better job informing its viewers about money and politics than regular news networks such as CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and Broadcast News Television. I'm not exactly sure how they measured that, but they came to that conclusion at the Annenberg Center at University of Pennsylvania. So here's about 30 seconds of Colbert and Jon Stewart on the Super PAC in a segment where Colbert transfers power of his Super PAC to Stewart so Colbert could run for office in South Carolina.
If I may, can we do this? Because you and I are also business partners.
Yes, we're business
partners. About to open up that combination bagel shop.
And travel agency.
Yes. From Schmear to eternity.
Is that a problem? Trevor, is being business partners a problem?
Being business partners does not count as coordination legally.
Great.
All right.
So his lawyer there at the end of the clip, do you have to be Jewish to get the joke from Schmear to eternity? But Kurt Anderson, it's such a great example of how a comedy show taught more average Americans about super PACs than some explainer on CNN.
Absolutely. It was that the whole super PAC thing, which went on and on and on, and they brought back the former FEC lawyer Trevor Potter to explain that, no, you can do this extraordinarily unbelievable, egregious thing again and again. It was a genius piece of performance art, and as you say, really useful in letting people know how jaw-dropping the rules governing campaign contributions in this country are.
Look who's calling in. It looks like, if it's the real, Alexis Ohanian, the creator of Reddit in Brooklyn. Alexis, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hello. Oh, thank you for having me. And yes, it is really me. I feel bad for someone who is impersonating me.
You will vouch for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what do you want to say? And thanks for calling. And you're another one, by the way. I mean, you know, because I don't know how many millennials get their news from Reddit, from the conversations that are started there, who would never turn on NPR or conventional network.
Well, don't sell yourself short. I think a lot of the great NPR content bubbles up on the Reddit front page. We're happy to guide them to it.
But also that.
You know, for me, we started, actually, Steve Huffman, my co-founder, and I started Reddit the same year that the Colbert Report started in 2005. And so I remember seeing these videos bubbling up. At the time, they were not so legally uploaded to YouTube. But it was great because we were in this little apartment. We didn't have cable. And it was this respite from a very hectic, very busy kind of startup life. And I was personally going through some stuff with my mom at the hospital. And Colbert's show was this thing. You sort of talked about it earlier. It was this thing that always was something to look forward to, that always made me laugh. And I was so grateful for it. I was lucky enough to be on the show maybe last year. I got to tell Stephen this, but really it was remarkable to see what an impact that show had. And you know, in 2010 he organized with Jon Stewart the rally to restore sanity and or fear.
Yes.
In D.C. And I was there with hundreds of thousands of people by my best estimate, a number of whom even coordinated via Reddit to kind of organize it. And it all just kind of happened. And it was this manifestation of what was just a kind of silly idea, right, a satirical rally to mock Glenn Beck, but that became this thing, this sort of like very, very real thing. And it was a couple of comedy shows that mobilized all these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, how was your experience as a guest? I was on once. They had me on the day after Election Day last year to kind of explain, as the New York journalist, the election of de Blasio, liberal de Blasio, to the nation. And, you know, for me, it was such nerve-wracking fun because you don't know what the conservative talk show host character is going to throw at you and try to skewer you with, me with, as, oh, yeah, you call yourself a jerk, you're just liberal, you know, well, however they're going to do it. So you don't know what you're going to get, like a standard interview and how he's going to, the character is going to try to trip you up. So I had a lot of fun, but it was really nerve-wracking fun. What was your experience like?
Exactly the same, and I know having had my fair share of interviews, there's really nothing like it. It was terrifying, and friends of mine, or close people to me, knew how terrified I was, because if you pull away, if you see the pull away shots, my feet are just dancing underneath the table. I was kind of like a duck above the water. It looked pretty calm, but beneath. Very, very nervous. You don't know what to expect.
Terrifying is a good word. Alexa Sahanian, founder of Reddit, thank you very much for calling in.
Oh, thank you for having me. Love WNYC.
Thanks so much. So Kurt Anderson, host of Studio 360, produced by WNYC. I want to play one more Colbert clip. This is from his actual real-life congressional testimony in 2010, from the part of his testimony where he was out of character as himself. Here's about 20 seconds.
I like talking about people who don't have any power. And this seems like one of the least powerful people in the United States are migrant workers who come and do our work but don't have any rights as a result. And yet we still invite them to come here and at the same time ask them to leave. And that's an interesting contradiction to me.
So maybe there's a little window into what we'll call the real Colbert that I guess we'll get on his new CBS show. Though that wasn't that, you know, funny a clip, that he has something serious to say. What do you think we learned from that line?
Well, that he is, you know, a person of, you know, with some actual moral compass, and from what we've read about his very conventional, worthy father churchgoer life, it doesn't seem to be any kind of put on. The other thing I think that I want to make sure we celebrate is what an extraordinarily good interviewer he was. And when he was in his interview mode, yes, he was the farcical, fictional right winger sometimes, but he was also really good at it and really, you know, explored the book that he was talking about, yes, or the film or the whatever, and with such quickness. Both as a guest once I experienced it, but just the other night he had an author on. The author mentioned the Iliad. He wrote his fiction imagining the Iliad. Immediately, Colbert made a couple of amazing, obscure references to characters in the Iliad. So he's a good interviewer and so bright and quick.
Yeah, and so maybe that's an indication that he'll be able to pull off this transition. Because
correct,
I think
yeah,
for, you know, most television viewers, it's a complete mystery. I'm sure I suspect they know what they're doing behind the scenes, but for most people, they've never seen Colbert out of character, and they're like, what is this going to be when he's doing a late-night talk show as himself?
Yeah, no, and I'm sure for him, too. It's good that there's a long interregnum between being Stephen Colbert every day and being Stephen Colbert, regular person, at 11:30 on CBS, just so that he can manage to morph fully into his ordinary self before he takes that job.
Amy in Manhattan has a question about the forthcoming Colbert. Amy, you're on WNYC with Kurt Anderson.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. Apropos of this morphing, I'm wondering if it's going to include the pronunciation of his name. Is this going to be Colbert, or is he going to call himself Stephen Colbert?
Yes. Will he revert? I guess he was raised Colbert. Is that true? Do you know, Kurt?
I actually think it has been Colbert for a long period of time, and the rapport is the you know, joke on that.
Wait,
so
do you have a Christmas song as your ringtone right now, Kurt?
No, that wasn't a Christmas song.
Oh, okay. I
I'd be happy to have a Christmas song. I engage in no war against Christmas whatsoever. But
it's hard, of course, you know, just to conclude the point, and then we're going to go on and talk about the cancellation of the interview, the movie. But it's hard to imagine someone like David Letterman or Jimmy Fallon or Leno, any of the late night guys from any generation, you know, I don't know, you know, Steve Allen or Johnny Carson, testifying in front of Congress the way we just heard.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine them taking the kind of, or really dishing the kind of political jabs. I wonder if you think he's going to be a polarizing figure in a way that might hurt his ratings, since those other hosts don't usually get associated with a political point of view, and he kind of is.
I feel as though he, as soon as he got the job, a whole bunch of conventional right-wing pundits said, oh, look, CBS hates America. Stephen Colbert is such a left-winger.
Right.
I don't see that happening for a lot of reasons. I think he is such a likable and earnest character who I don't think he every night is going to be saying, oh, I disagree with this vote in the House of Representatives. I don't think it's going to be that. I'd be very surprised. I think he will be sparing and careful in when he expresses political opinions. But yeah, he will. And it's so interesting the space he's carved out, I think, to do that, because it's not a Mort Saul and his descendants version. It's not just here's my opinion and here's another opinion.
Yeah.
I think it will be, to me, refreshing to have somebody who does have an understanding of history, of politics, of society, in a way that, you know, is part of his what he'll do, in a way, as you say, absolutely, that Seth Meyers and Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel, as talented as they are all in their respective ways, don't really go there unless it becomes, you know, something in politics becomes so absurd it can't escape a joke. I think we will see an interesting difference in that sense with Colbert. And polarizing, I don't. Again, my regard for Colbert is so high. I think he's going to be able to thread that needle well.
All right. We will find out starting next year. Kurt Anderson, host of Studio 360 on WNYC, is with me as we talk some media. And I want to turn now to the other story of media satire in the news right now, and that, of course, is the movie The Interview, about two journalists who kill the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. Fiction, satire, we should say, in case anybody's confused about that. It's with James Franco and Seth Rogen, the two actors behind the stoner slacker movie Pineapple Express and others. And the film's release was canceled by Sony, as most of you have heard, after North Korean hackers breached Sony's system and posted private company emails and other data, including movies, online. And there was a threat from these North Korean hackers to, quote, remember the attacks of September 11th, although the State Department has said that that attack doesn't, or that threat doesn't seem serious or credible. So, listeners, here's the question, and it actually turned out to be the lead editorial in the New York Times today. Do you think the movie should have been pulled? Time says no. Do you see this as censorship? Do you see it as cowardice and intimidation? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you don't know the background, here's a clip of the trailer from The Interview, which has not been pulled from the web.
You two are going to be in a room alone with Kim.
We got The Interview!
The CIA would love it if you could take him out.
Hmm?
Take him out.
Like for drinks?
Like to dinner?
Take him out in the town?
No, take him out.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
So, Kurt Anderson, right away, from those 20 seconds, everybody will get the idea. This is not exactly 24, and
no.
This is not exactly, you know, a documentary.
It is not. I've not seen the film, but it obviously is a very broad comedy in which, you know, we can imagine how it goes for its hour and a half, 2 hours. It's extraordinary that apparently the North Koreans, and let's make it clear, we don't know with certainty that the North Koreans did this, but let's presume that they did, and that seems to be the consensus. The North Korean regime has been, both Kim Jong-un and his father, Kim Jong-il, have been manifestly and for
generations obsessed with Hollywood films. So it's not surprising that a comedy that makes fun of them and depicts the killing of the current glorious leader would upset them. The fact that they would go to this the extent of the big hack doesn't. I mean, that's plausible. The idea that there, as you say, that there was some meaningful, credible threat to people who would have been in theaters this weekend seeing it seems ridiculous to me, and I find it sad understandable but sad that Sony Pictures kind of caved in to this vague and anonymous threat.
Here is a caller, George in Manhattan. I don't think it's that George, but he may make the same point. I'll explain. George, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Enjoy your show today.
And I already can tell from your voice that you're not the George who I had in mind, but go ahead.
What George did you have in mind?
Well, go ahead and make your point, and then I'll tie it together.
Okay, very good. My point was that, yes, the movie should be released, not necessarily in theaters where people can be bombed or destroyed, if that's possible, but certainly on a disc or some way that people get a chance to buy it for Christmas or buy it for some, you know, evening enjoyment on a, you know, one of these little discs that they sell.
Yeah, DVD or release it online. George, thank you very much. And Kurt Anderson, of course, what I was thinking of is that George Clooney has come out publicly and said there should be online release of the film. Do you think that's a way for Sony Pictures to thread the needle?
It would be one way. And, of course, Sony, given the whole problem of their online email personnel records being released over the last month, may be a little feel a little wary inside that what must be a nightmarish corporate environment right now to engage in this sort of unprecedented online release. But yes, that, you know, that would be one way to do it, I think. You know, obviously would that would not invite this probably imaginary idea of physical violence in reaction. So yeah, I would encourage them to do that. Of course, the other thing that happened in the last couple of days, some theaters wanted to show the film Team America, which also makes fun of the North Korean regime from 10 years ago, and Paramount Pictures, which put out that movie, denied them access to that film as well. So it is to me, what seems like a slightly hysterical overreaction by Hollywood seems to have not be limited to Sony.
And I gather, though Team America is a 10-year-old film, a theater in Texas, a theater in Cleveland, and a theater in Atlanta were about to screen it for whatever reason. I don't know if that was a coincidence, it's just a funny 10-year-old film that they were going to put on late night or something like that, or if this was a little pushback against Sony for pulling the interview, do you know? But then Paramount asked them, you don't do this either.
Yes, exactly. And again, what one knows and understands how the default corporate instinct is, oh, nope, let's not do anything that will be, you know, could possibly cause any trouble. But I you know, agree with the New York Times. I think it's unfortunate you don't want to.
Right. Nobody wants to be the one who puts it in the theaters, ignores the threat, and then people get killed.
No. Exactly. And I understand it's not the United States government doing this. It's individual companies with fiduciary duty. But, gosh, if it's this easy, you know, if you're North Korea or whomever it is or whomever it could be, whatever non-state actor wants to do something like this in the future, you establish this precedent, it could well be a slippery slope.
Natalie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Natalie.
Hello. Well, I have a very different take on this. You see, I think that this movie went too far, that the people were very casual and did not in any way take into account the reaction or what they were really doing, that when you try to humiliate South Koreans, the South Korean
North
leaders.
Korea. North Korea.
You're doing a very, very dangerous thing. It's a kind of provocative thing. I think they could interpret it actually as an act of terrorism. I think the movie should never have been made. I think they got absolutely what they deserve for doing such a stupid, foolhardy thing and endangering people in the United States. I think it was totally unnecessary. If they wanted to write about assassinating someone, they could have assassinated another, you know, an anonymous South Korean, certainly not
North Korea,
not the head
just
of the government. And I think that Sony absolutely did the right thing in pulling the movie. This is not, you know, these people are really politically extremely unsophisticated, the people who made the movie. They have no idea what they're getting into or what they're doing.
Natalie,
you just can't do that.
Natalie, thank you. And, you know, Kurt, imagine if Russia, I don't even know if they make movies in North Korea, so, and it's such a closed society. I'm not even going to use North Korea example. Yeah. How about if Russia, somebody in Russia made a broad satire based on the premise of assassinating President Obama. We're going to take that very lightly and shrug
it
off.
Of course not. But go for it. You know, this is a world that we believe and want to have been progressing toward free speech for the last several hundred years. No, we wouldn't be happy. When Nicholson Baker, the great novelist, published a book in which a main plot point was people imagining the assassination of George W. Bush, it got all kinds of criticism and condemnation in this country and elsewhere. Should have, if people wanted to condemn it, fine. But nobody threatened to destroy the publisher or do anything else. So, you know, the idea that there are just certain things off limits because somebody's going to be so angry, therefore they shouldn't be said, is you know, not an idea I want to sign on to.
All right. Listeners, what do you think? Should they release the interview anyway? Go post it to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer, or use Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. Kurt Anderson, host of Studio 360, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Same to you.
And there were so many people on hand to say goodbye to the Colbert Report last night and sing a song together. Big Bird, Neil deGrasse Tyson, James Franco, Willie Nelson, Cory Booker, Alan Alda, Dorrance Kearns Goodwin, see her there, Mayor Bill de Blasio, David Gregory, Christiane Amanpour, President Bill Clinton, Patrick Stewart, Katie Couric, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Tom Friedman, the Cookie Monster. This is exhausting. You get the point. It was incredible. So we'll go out as Colbert did with We'll Meet Again.